Eschatologists agree that the end of human history is fast approaching, but maybe it isn't. The seventh talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by Toby Johnson on August 3, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. Thank you all very much for being here. Thank you, Jack, for putting himself on the line intellectually. What remarkable bravery, and I mean that entirely sincerely. I went to Gutenberg, and it was the best experience ever. And Jack's distinctions that he brought into my life about how to make sense of works and faith and grace and the God that's controlling a world that very much times looks remarkably harsh and remarkably cruel, it was the most formative experience of my life. And in addition to the other professors, David, who taught me so much about the Old Testament, so much about history, so much about a kind of the donkeys live a long time from the animal farm, this kind of mentality of kind of going, yeah, like, but. And that just kind of equal fairness was really enjoyable. And then Ron also, and who was my humanities teacher, very, very human person, very, very compassionate and very real in that sense. And then Dick, who just tolerated me in his Greek class and taught me English at the same time he was talking to me Greek. It was a marvelous experience for me, and I can mention all the professors. They were all were extraordinarily patient and very knowledgeable. I want to thank my wife because she was up all night with our teething baby, and that was nice because I remember the baby crying, but I didn't actually touch the baby the whole night, which is rare. I like that baby, but which is rare. Yeah, usually I have night duties. I like night duties because me and him play video games. He has no real coordination, so I win. So that's it. And then I'm glad you're all here in the summer institute. Awesome. My paper, which was abbreviated for the thing, is the full title is Eschatologists Agree That the End of Human History is Fast Approaching, but what my presentation presupposes is maybe it isn't. So what are we going to do? Jack put this paper forward. There's an urgency in Jack's words. There's a coming storm that Jack is foreseeing. And I want in this paper to highlight how, yeah, sure, I agree with Revelations. I'm cool with Revelations. It's a good book. It's there for a reason. But with what we're looking at in regards to our culture, are we really seeing the end of everything? Or are we seeing just a dramatic demographic shift that we have never, ever, ever seen before? By that I mean, the boomers have been here a long time. And so I'm going to talk a lot about generational politics. I'm going to talk a lot about the culture war. I'm going to highlight those different elements and how my generation perceived them with the hopes that you'll understand why it's nothing personal. Like, why where we're going is actually kind of interesting. And I would never claim that we're doing something as, how do I say it, as introspective as what I conceive of as the 60s being about, the 60s being the conflict between the traditional the conformity of the 50s versus the social kind of momentum of the hippies and rock and roll and all the exciting stuff that happened there. I don't think we are as on top of our game with respect to that dynamic. We're not saying, because in some ways we weren't presented a unified thing to rebel against. We have this really weird thing which I'm going to call the culture war, and that informs two different generational camps. The generational camp that was raised predominantly in a progressive household or a secular household or whatever synonym you want, a beastly household, no, and those people who are raised evangelical, and that would be me. I think we're just going to play a game. I had this other thing we're going to do, but we're not going to do it. We're going to play a game, all right, and you're going to rate your trust of me. People who know me can't play this game, no. You're going to rate this trust of me. I'm going to say true things about me, and I want you to rate your trust of my position or your kind of intuitiveness about what I might be saying or whether you like me or whether I am saying attractive things to you, and then I'm going to say some other stuff. These things are true, one being not trusting, 10 being very trusting. These things are true. I was homeschooled. That's true. I went to Gutenberg, obviously. I wrote my thesis on Kierkegaard. Very awesome. My brother went to Gutenberg. My father was a pastor, and I voted for Bush 2 both times. So there's a number in your mind. You're like, okay, ideologically, I know what Peter thinks. You don't have to worry about his number. These things are also true. My parents divorced after my father left my mother when I was 17. I was also divorced. I'm not now. I wrote my paper on Nietzsche. I voted for Obama both times, and
I like rap music.
Oh my God! So, if the number changed in your mind, if you're kind of going, well, maybe he's not so cool. Like, that's kind of what I'm hoping to address. I'm hoping to address that these things I've described are what I eventually will later in the paper call trivial. But we'll deal with it later. So, part one, the origin of the culture war. What are we fighting for? I don't know, and I don't give a damn. Does anybody know who's that? That's like not mine. That's your guys' stuff. Most boomers, I mean. So, who's that? Thank you for Country Girls. That was a good song, too. The title's even more funny. So, I'm here to talk about the longest war. It's not the Korean War, which was 3 years. It's not the Vietnam War, which was 16. It's not the Iraq-Afghan, which at this point is coming up on its 13th. This is what I'm going to be describing as the culture war. I know my history. Thank you, David Crabtree. I know about a tennis court in France. I know about how the Enlightenment Project worked in regards to dealing with new ways of sizing up its culture, elements that want to bring about dramatic change in a culture, elements that are traditionally more traditional, if that's redundant. So in some sense, I'm talking specifically about the ideological schism that I see in the boomer generation. Between what we would call, I mean, perhaps derogatorily, perhaps complimentatively, hippies, and those people who were other, or those people who would be more traditional there. Jack outlined a few nights ago how the traditionalists in academia, with the rise of modernism, retreated. They were like, I'm out of here. Like, modernism rose, and he highlighted that earlier. It was super illuminating for me, because I didn't know that at all. And he then kind of footnoted, and the evangelicals reject the traditionalist response. The evangelicals are going to war. Now, again, it's called a culture war for a reason, and it's cult, and whether you like it or not, that's a terminology that came from what I would call the right, or the pseudo-right, or whatever synonymous thing you want for that side of the room, that side of the tennis court. That is what I'm identifying that as a culture war. The culture war, in theory, people are supposing it, that it might actually have wrapped up or might come to an end in 2011 with the re-election of Barack Hussein Obama. The section of the culture war that we experienced, my generation experienced, was 80s on. So it was the 1980s Ronald Reagan. It was Pat Buchanan in 1990, if we all remember Pat. It was Newt Gingrich in 1998. Good old Newt. It was George W. Bush in 2001. It was the conservative activist judges. You guys probably already hate that. Some of you do. Anyway, we're moving on. It's DOMA. It's Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was the way the culture war was perceived politically. That's what I'm addressing. Let's not get carried away. I'm not talking about faith yet. We'll get there later. I'm saying the unique elements of the culture war is the alliance between evangelical Christians and the Republican Party, the pseudo-right, as Jack called them. That the left were on the ropes for 20 years, that there was a Clinton impeachment trial, that there was a contest between Gore and Bush, that Bush 2 really never provided weapons of mass destruction after he invaded Iraq, that our vice president was CEO of a military contracting firm that benefited from said war, or that the left has done the things they've done is of secondarily important with respect to the culture war too, because the essence of the culture war is the evangelicals aligning with the political right. That is what I'm saying. This ultimately was a marriage of kind of political convenience, politics make strange bedfellows. That is the conservative alliance. Many, the Republicans happily, and I wrote down, the Republican platform happily carried the evangelical banner for an exchange for evangelical vast electoral clout. From the 2 terms under Reagan, single term under Bush, large gains in House and Senate under Clinton, 2 terms under Bush II, and the election of Clarence Thomas, Judge Roberts, and Antonin Scalia, countless other legislative blasts, it is clear that the bargain was beneficial for both sides. The end of the culture war is not the beginning of liberal political dominance. I'm pretty sure that they're going to try to push Hillary, and Hillary is of the old school. She is not yet us. I'm not saying we're not going to vote for Hillary or we collectively. I'm not going to say the liberals will vote for Hillary, but don't think of Hillary. Obama's the historical anomaly. Obama's doing something else. And I know that there are a lot of people who camp him with that tradition of culture war. I don't necessarily think that he would fall under the definition of a culture warrior or that he's participating in culture war. Or I think rather he seems to exemplify to the previous generations the non-culture war, the counter-culture of the culture war. We'll get on that later. So, not necessarily are we going to be talking about liberal political dominance. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I also don't think that the Republicans' political ambitions are over. So, we're really just addressing the fact that evangelicals will no longer be necessarily the darlings of the Republican Party. Evangelicals will never be pursued as faithfully. Never again will they have such political capital to suspend. Evangelicals as a political force are on the decline, from what I can tell. Jack's realization that he will not win over a culture is a part of that. There's a lot I can unpack there. There's a lot of interesting moves that our generation doesn't take for granted that perhaps another generation would, an older generation would. That those two things would be synonymous. That the rise of Christianity and the sense of its biblical truth, that it got married to the political ups and downs of this of a political party in this country, seem peculiar to me. We'll go on. So there are naturally solutions. There are responses now. I think part of this institute is the response. Jack's response to what I'm describing as the culture war is what he wrote in his paper. I can't totally say I understand Jack as much as I understood Ron's refutation of Jack. I think Jack is talking about the fact that dark things are coming. And it seems to be this theme of the beast, and it seems to be he's reading Revelation, so the information of Revelations is giving him insight into the current times. I'll be honest, my data set's upside down. I'm actually looking at the current times and then and going toward what I think the Bible's talking about with respect to faith. I'm not starting at Revelations. I'm not a Revelation scholar. I really don't have the time. I have kids. Like, there's a lot you gotta do. And so, Jack's reading of Revelations is paramount to his interpretation of the data in this culture, and my generationalness is paramount to my interpretation of the same data. So be clear about where that is. So there are a few options, and Jack highlighted one. I don't think Jack argued for cessation explicitly, but there is definitely the option of being like the traditionalists. There's a fortress mentality we can pursue. We can withdraw from the culture. We can make smaller social groups. Some of this element of talking about social groups is a little unnerving to me. It sounds like we're going to be hiding our faith under a bushel. It sounds like we're going to be retreating with those people that are what I would say the militant pseudo right. They're actually just militant. I mean, they have guns and things. And so there's a population of America's there's a section of America's population that seems to be making that move as well. I've met older gentlemen who, again, I love them. They can totally go to heaven. It's not my problem. But they politically are digging holes in the ground and stockpiling ham because of Obama's win. And I'm not going to judge that. It's not my place. I would win no hearts here if I was like, that's stupid. No, I mean, if that's what God's called them to do, sure. Do I think that's what we could do? We could do other things. So there's a thing called the Citadel. I would invite you to look it up. I knew it was coming, and it's here. And it's basically, from what I can tell, the Citadel is a gated community for people who are a part of the militia. And you would buy a plot like you would in a gated community. I'm not making this up. This is in Idaho. Therefore, that's why you know it's real. And you buy a plot, and you have to, you know, your kids have to be submitted to militia training, and everyone has to hit their targets or they lose their lot in this thing. So this is a form of response to what the culture's doing. That's there. I'm not going to say necessarily that's legitimate or I advise it, but that's there. There are people who are heading for the hills. There are people who, and they're heading for the hills because the evangelical fight it out doesn't seem to be going their way. So, part two, I'm going to start with two quotes. Beware that when fighting monsters, you yourself do not become a monster. For when you gaze long into the abyss gazes also into you. Friedrich Nietzsche. When Augustine speaks of revelation, he is not speaking of biblical revelation alone. He is also concerned with general and natural revelation. Not only are truths in Scripture dependent upon God's revelation, but all truths include scientific truth is dependent upon divine revelation. This is why Augustine encourages students to learn as much as possible at about as many things as possible. For him, all truths are God's truths, and when one encounters truth, one encounters the God of whose truth it is. It's a great quote. R.C. Sproul, being the intellectual coward I am, I felt I needed to justify my Nietzsche quote with one from R.C. Sproul. So, I think I highlighted this a little. To be clear, the culture war is not about faith. I know that many people, because the culture war was personal, it seemed that faith was an element of it. I'm not addressing how you felt during the last 30 years of politics. I'm not addressing how you felt when you watched I will just say, I'm assuming, again, we're speaking from the right perspective, but as you watched various activist groups go about their desires to implement their own legislation, I'm not saying that you could not feel personally offended or threatened or confused or frightened. I am not saying that you can't be personally invested as somebody who believes in God to wanting God not to be outlawed. Like, or to feel threatened that there are certain things that the government policy comes down and it looks like the beast. It looks unnerving. Like, we all, I think there's something about the boomer generation that we, and our, all generations that will come, that we're all raised on the Holocaust. The Holocaust is such a fundamental moment in horror for all of us that we're all, I think, in the back of our heads worried that if this boat tips one too many ways, we'll have camps again. Now, there's something about our makeup that's terrified of that. I'm not saying we shouldn't have that in our mind. We should never forget our past, but that feels palpable in some ways politically. That feels like, oh, and then this atrocity. Now, I don't know if it's going to happen soon. It could happen. It could never happen. I don't know. I have a suspicion America will crumble in a really remarkably unique way. 400,000 years from now, Jack. So the culture war, we are simply, it has no spiritual or existential reality. I'm not talking about the culture war as a spiritual experience or a existential experience. I'm speaking out about it strictly politically. We are not discussing faith, its inner workings. We're not discussing Jesus and one's commitment to Jesus. We are talking exclusively about the politicization of the evangelical Christian values within the boomer generations from the predefined dates. The culture war, now that I've cut off all this extra stuff, the culture then war is not about faith, but it's about power. It is the power to define and confine. It is the power of values, which is another word for political orthodoxy, I'm going to maintain. The stickiness of what we're about to walk into is because it's a culture war, there's an element of you have to pick sides in a war. And how do people decide who's on what side? Well, it's not through critical thinking. Critical thinking is always the first casualty of war. Like, the ability to be open to new ideas is always the first casualty of war. Like, the ability to be excited about someone different from you is always the first casualty in war. And so my generation sees this. I think people who are still in the trenches, culturally speaking, it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to see. It's a lot harder to see someone. I mean, Ron brought up, can someone on the left be a biblicalist or whatever? And that was a fun discussion. I mean, this idea that this other person who could take away my freedoms to be an American in this country, we're less excited about that in the course of a culture war. When there's no culture war, I could conceive of there being actually what's called a dialogue about where we are. But that hasn't been the case for a while. Could it be the case? You guys have to wait. That's the point. Culture war was never about faith, but power to define and confine people's values, which is another word for political orthodoxy. Morality during this period was often used as a litmus test for each superior class religion. Now, I want Jack to agree with me. I don't know if he will. But he lays out, I mean, the superior class, he nailed it. He nailed that. Like, man, he parses that out appallingly. I'm going to maintain that there are two of them. I will maintain that the Republicans or the right wing has the exact same mentality. They operated the exact same way. They were just as insidious. They employed propaganda. They employed morality as a litmus test. They said, well, what do you believe? Oh, this? You're over there. Politically speaking. There was a superior class on both sides. There just was. Like, because, and how do I know? Because I was raised evangelical. Like, I was raised where I went to church and people would ask me what version of the Bible I was translating verses out of. And I was being sized up there. Like, that was a big deal. Like, that's not even about biblical interpretation. That's literally about the version of the Bible I'm picking to read. I remember I went to go pick a Bible and I was there and this very nice, and do I think this person's the devil? Absolutely not. He's just implementing a false sense of community. He's implementing what he thinks is important for his superior class morality. Could he be in heaven? Absolutely. We're not talking about faith right now. Stop thinking about heaven and hell. He's all right. But I was picking out a Bible. It's I pick American Standard. Don't judge me. I just like it. I don't know what. So, and I tell him that, and I go, so I'm going to pick American Standard. And he goes, oh, that's interesting. Why'd you pick that? And I go, I feel like the translation's a little sparse, and therefore I could go to the Greek if I wanted to find out what it was saying. I thought that was the right answer. I mean, if you mention the Greek when you're talking about biblical interpretation, I feel like that's the right answer. The guy should be like, oh, the Greek. Yeah, I don't know the Greek. And what he said was, and I said, you know, I feel like, you know, I can go to the Greek if I want the translation. And he goes, you mean if the Lord's going to give you translation? And I was like, oh, he got me again. Like, he knew. Like, and that is a small, trivial element, but that magnified by what my generation experienced from both sides. From the what I would call liberal hypocrisy and liberal superior classness, in the sense of like, I noticed that you didn't put that aluminum can in the recycling. Like, that's the other version of it. Like, we're not talking about anything other than human nature here, and its desire to feel superior, and its desire to size up other people to see if they're worth our time. And he, Jack, addressed Democracy in America. Please read Democracy in America. How we, when you strip down a sort of false in European social hierarchy, democracy becomes like really, really hashed, really, really clicky, really sizey uppy. I don't know. There's a word that's probably not an E and Y, but really, we sort each other out really quickly. We have to find out who's on our side, who's not on our side. Why? Because there's billions of us. And specifically, to remind you guys, the boomers, you guys are called the boomers because of the population boom. You guys have known not just a lot of military conflict, but you guys have been perpetually competing with your contemporaries, and specifically with the culture war. Like, that's ingrained in you. It's the sizing up. It's ingrained in my generation too. This is America. Like, we are part of a democracy, so we have to talk to someone and find if they like us or not very, very quickly. So that's how we accrue power in some sense, that's what I'm saying. So I don't think Jack is wrong about the superior class. I just want there to be two of them. And I want those two of them to be fighting for the last 30 to 40 years politically. That's the best I can do. Because that's the only way I can make sense of the data I experienced as somebody who believes in God and has perpetually felt confused by the response of people who claim they believe in God. And I don't mean confused politically. I mean confused, like, I walk into their church and they go, I'm going to need you to take your hat off. And I go, oh, okay. And he goes, oh, your hair's not combed. Like, and I'm like, ah. Like, so those elements, like, and I think we've all encountered a level of hypocrisy from Christians who could still have great hearts and still go to, but they're valuing something and they're sizing us up and we're being measured. And I'm sure that the liberals in their communist camps have the same kind of feeling of like, how excited are you about Marxism? I'm okay. Well, you need to go. Like, so it's part of the human dynamic. It's part of being an American in democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And this is probably then the easier part of the speech. You're now about to head into it. What I think the good news when they talk about the superior class religion and how I'm going to bifurcate it in Pub 2 is Ron's argumentation is that the boogeyman of socialist / secular / left / progressive power, as Ron describes, can never touch faith. And neither could the conservative superior class. You can't touch faith. Like, what Ron said yesterday, it was emotionally for me, it was right on. Is the idea that God can sanctify who he decides to sanctify. All of our fear about whether this culture is going one direction or another, I don't get it. I didn't get Jack's paper for that reason almost. It doesn't feel, I don't know why we would be pessimistic or optimistic. God's going to do the God thing that he does. Like, this is the God. I mean, and who am I saying this out of? I'm saying this to somebody who's an entire devotee to the concept of divine determinism. The concept that the great author God, the God who's the creator of the whole world, he picks. He could sanctify everyone in America tomorrow if that was what he was doing. Like, and we would see what would be called a reformation in some way. But so whatever infrastructure you stack on top of the individual's existential commitment to the Bible, it seems irrelevant. Granted, you can be thrown in jail for being sincere about your faith. I don't think we're there yet in America because, well, we'll get there too. Okay, part three, spilt milk. Ah, this is the one I lose sleep over, besides my child yelling, which is cool. He's got little buds at teeth. I've never had a baby, so it's really weird to watch a baby be like personhooded. You're like, oh, before you were just this kind of grub, and now you're like. I think there's a really remarkable moment in everyone's experience as a parent where you realize your kid is a jerk, kind of. Like, where you take something from him, and he's just like, it's the first moment where he's just like, America's about private property. What are you doing? Why are you taking my thing? Like, how could you possibly, I'm going to call my congressman. Like, are you out of your mind? Like, and the look on their face is that, look, like, I'm writing a letter to my congressman right now. Like, you are going down. Like, I want that toothbrush back right now. So I just had that. It's just really fun. So part three is called Spilled Milk. Why the Republicans, and I'm going to say you in the general sense, why you lost the culture war. Evangelicals were doomed to lose the culture war for two important reasons. Because like it or not, monotheocratic legislation is a violation of the tenets of democratic free society. I will say it another way. The Republican attempt to ratify evangelical morality as law was un-American from the very beginning and contrary to the very spirit of liberty upon which this country had been established. It was contrary to the very spirit of equality. I know that a lot of you believe this to be a godly nation, and I think when I bump up against why this seems appalling is because a connection was made somewhere on this side, and I guess this would be my right, so we're on the right side, that this nation was founded by Bible believers, by people who understood the Bible, and what Jack said, who are inheritors of the beautifulness of how the Gospels have shaped Western civilization. He's absolutely right. Western civilization is what it is because we conceive of a rational, beautiful God who values each person. God loves all the children, as the book said, is not incorrect. So that remarkable respect for humanity, whether the left, secular, progressive, intellectuals, whatever, whether they acknowledge it, it's shaped everything. It's shaped the dignity that we give human beings. It's shaped in some ways the weird tick in the back of our head about doing unto others. Like, that's profound in our culture. And I would never take that away. Were the founding fathers religious? Absolutely. They understood the Bible as well as many other things. When I think about America being, there's this, and Jack touches on it, about America being, there's this golden age of faith, I always can't figure out when that is. Like, because I remember, again, I know of America through its conflicts and through its, in some ways, through the clear eye of perceiving where America has let us down as a people. Where there was slavery, and then there were the Mexican-American wars, and there were the Indian wars, and then there was Jim Crow, and then there was suffrage. And so as we go through America, I don't see America as being a perfect union, nor do I see it as nor do I know what time period. I mean, maybe Jack could supply, like, 1947. That was it. I don't know. But when I look at the beautiful pageant of America, and don't get me wrong, I love America. It's the best country in the world. I never want to be anywhere. Please do not accuse me of being not patriotic. I'm very, very patriotic. But it's hard for me to see at what point we're talking about when we're talking about America being a Christian nation with respect to a intellectual commitment to the truth of the Bible that's based on reason and therefore manifesting itself with the true expression of faith. Well, I don't think that happened for any culture. And what we're talking about with respect to the Jews in the end times is that's what happens. And I think if that happened here, we would be that. So I'm assuming that that's only going to happen once. I'm assuming that all societies are this complicated arrangement of contracts and bureaucrats and fundamentally there will always be few and lesser. I feel like that's in the Bible somewhere in the back, I swear. So the road is narrow. I feel like that's the case. When someone points to America that's a little more cool with the Bible, are they pointing to a moment where politicians are exemplifying a biblical, a rational biblicist perspective? There were moments where Christianity was cooler, but was that Christianity what we're talking about here when we talk about faith? You'd have to make that argument too. So there's two obstacles to me understanding America being a Christian nation. I don't get it wrong. We are founded on the great ideas of the Bible as much as we're also found of the Enlightenment. I mean, I don't know if you guys know about Enlightenment. It's cool. It's good too. So moving on. So I see why, and I can imagine and put myself in the head of people who are going, well, I really believe that some rights should be had by some and some shouldn't be had by others. And I want America to match my heart, and the Bible is what's telling me my heart should be like this. So I'm going to vote my conscience. Like, now I can put myself there. I'm just still selling you. Like, whether you like it or not, America is about liberty, equality, and freedom, and you can't do that. So, I mean, you can do it, and that's what's great about democracy, is you can vote your conscience, and you can get it. And now we're at the end of the culture war, and evangelicals have lost. And they've lost because they were un-American. My second point is they've lost because they were never really that evangelical. Like, this ties a little into what I was talking about earlier about the superior class. And Jack mentioned Mammon, the god in the Old Testament that's conceived as being like a money-like god. And it's funny that he then flipped over and talked about the left because capitalism is capitalism. Like, I mean, that's both sides are remarkably materialist. They just are. Both sides are unquestioning about whether you buy new clothing and how important social status is with respect to one's monetary income. So again, Mammon, yeah, I see Mammon both sides. And so evangelicals, for lack of a better phrase, in their pursuit of political power, turned the house of God into a den of thieves. And I know it's impossible for some of you to grasp what I mean by that, but listen to how my generation has dealt with the culture war and what we've seen. Because it has not been, we have not conceived of faith and the Bible as something that sets us free. We have conceived of it as something we would choose sides on, something that we'll be ultimately judged by socially and politically. So we're going to go on. From this perspective, the greatest threat to faith, and in this way I'm addressing why I was talking about evangelicals the first night, the real beast has always been and could only be the church. I would agree with Jack, if Jack wants to agree with me, that the church's abandonment of rational biblicism in favor of social standing, civic opinion, the emotional experience of the spiritual is really the evil I'm concerned about. There are other evils. But I don't get them. I get the ones about us. I get where the church stands between us and clarity, us and God, us and understanding faith and what faith's asking for us. I don't care about the machinations of Hillary Clinton as much as I care that my local pastor is not saying, "Yeah, you're saved. Don't worry about it. You're fine. You have Jesus living in your heart," which is the bizarrest analogy I could ever imagine. And look at all the cultural factors that made Christianity get weird. Like, evangelicals talk weirdly. I mean, to have a war is to have propaganda. To have propaganda is to create analogies that seem easy to understand. It is to create ways that we can all agree that we're agreeing. Like, morality becomes this way for us to say, well, we don't have to question our faith right now. We're really engaged in this big struggle. You pray every day? Cool, you're in. Are we voting this way, right? We're voting this way? Okay, great, let's do that. Like, the very nature of this struggle has deformed our ability to earnestly seek after a faith that might take us outside our social circles. Really articulate for not having been on my paper. So, it's the evangelicals devoid of questions and further inquiry, evangelicals that seem to have co-opted the biblical truth as a secret handshake for social and political organizations. It has become the rallying cry for a conservative agenda, a pseudo-right agenda. Worst of all, and this, I go into Kierkegaard's leap, the concept of the leap is the idea that the Bible, the importance of the Bible, the eminence of the Bible is that it asks you to take the Bible seriously. Like, we're not, I mean, that's, Paul talks about Jesus in a very similar fashion. Oh my goodness, if you are going to engage in the Bible, you are going to engage with it on a personal, existential, intellectual level. You will decide one way or another if you are reading, if you are engaged with the Bible, then you have a decision. And this, I sound a lot like Billy Graham or something. I didn't see that coming, but that's true. I have no problem with that, and I'm very traditional in that sense. Like, if we're going to engage in faith and go into our culture, we're simply saying, oh my goodness, if you are going to read the Bible, if you're going to say it's there, then you have to engage with the truth of it, and the truth of it is asking a truth of you. So going down to it, the most insidious element of evangelical Christianity, why I'm glad that if there is a beast, it squashes evangelical Christianity and ends the culture war, is because it had a tendency to convince its believers that the leap or that the commitment had been made. Like, when I was 7, we all had the conversion experience. I was 7, someone came in, they talked about hell, they said, Jesus Christ needs to come and live in your heart. And I said, that is what I'll do. What if I had thought that was it? Like, what if I thought it was like a punch card issue? I'm not talking about Florida. It's a different thing. But the punch card thing, like, oh, okay, I'm good. I made that decision. I'm good. No. The essence, Kierkegaard again, describes our faith as becoming, which is why I love Jack. Like, he wrote this paper. Do I think Jack will still believe in the things he wrote in his paper this week? No. Jack is going through becoming. Jack is coming into greater knowledge. Jack is coming into greater understandings of faith. Like, that is how great our author God is he's leading us through a narrative that sometimes takes a lot of us into really terrible places that evangelical Christianity is like, how'd you end up there? You're not over here with us. But that's what faith is. Like, faith is letting us meander through life with a remarkable seriousness of how we are in life. And so, the evangelicals and the political organizations of the time thought that voting a certain direction had any implications about one's eternal destination is baffling to me. And yet, that was perpetually implied in its superior class morality. It was perpetually this negotiation of, well, you can stand with us, but this is how we go down. I mean, we all, if we have had any experience in the church, it has been that weird, it reminds me of dogs sniffing each other's butts. That's very crass, but it's the way, I mean, I do the same thing over intellect, like philosophy at cafes. If you see people in cafes, like, oh, what are you reading, Nietzsche? Oh, that's cool. Like, but we've been to church, so we know what it feels like when someone says something to us that's a test. That's a test of whether they're cool with us. Like, are you post-trib or pre-trib? Like, and I'm just like, I don't know what trib is. Is that a game? I want to be the one that you are. I don't know. So, especially if I can date your daughter. No, it's a different thing. So, that's a whole different thing. We won't get that. So, in other words, it replaced this idea of faith, this idea of making the leap, with the word values. We we're just going to take this and values, and as long as you're down with these values and vote this way, we're cool. And so, I don't know how I can be afraid of leftist conspiracies with the beasts of governmental legislation that could outlaw the Bible compared to that lie. Like, that lie is so insidious that that's why I'm glad the culture war's over. I don't want people to think that faith is something they can resolve on a Sunday afternoon and they'll go forward and keep living. So the enemy has never been an outside force of oppression, but the hypocrisy and the pharisaical coercion of the religious organizations that we have inhabited. How could oppression of the less compare to the lies of the false prophet? As someone whose father has claimed to know and believe in the Bible, I can testify that his abandonment has been 1,000 times more confusing and damaging than Marxism. Ultimately, and I go into this briefly, I've already hit on it enough times that I'm probably going to skip the whole section, lucky you, but the reason why I don't find Jack's beast thing at all interesting, or it's not that it's interesting, remarkably interesting, but powerful or coercive or persuasive. Persuasive is the word. It's because for there to be a beast, there would have to be a faithful. And I'm just not seeing that. Like, when you look at, I mean, biblical truth would have to exist in a socio-political form for it to come under attack in a socio-political manner. And in other words, we've missed what we were being attacked by. We were actually, ironically, we've been engaging in culture war over things that are going to use the word trivial, but they're not. If you want to get persecuted, go get persecuted for the right thing. Who cares if you think these are the political things? I mean, there's no value or virtue in being persecuted for your politics. None at all. Or being an old white man. There's no value in it. It's totally irrelevant to God. You can go up there and be like, man, what was your number one culture warrior, God? And God's going to be like, what? I was working in your heart the whole time. I mean, that guy, ironically, the funny thing is, I'm not saying that that guy would go one way or another when we think of eternal destinations. Like, I'm saying that God would be like, okay, that's great. You might owe your kid an apology. But otherwise, you know, you come on in. There's this other thing that you were also doing that was what I was actually keeping track of. Okay, I highlighted this the other night, and I'm just going to kind of tie up this section with this. The beast I brought up with Jack. The beast in the Old Testament is the beast that if we're engaged with, I'm okay with. Ooh, that was really ambiguous. I brought up with Jack, it is only in the end times that the beast is brought against the righteous and the beast is brought low. And every other time the beast wins, and the beast wins because God brings the pagan empires against, it feels like a cleansing for the faithful. It feels like, when you look at the Old Testament, it looks like the Jews are doing their Jew thing, and slowly they want kings, and slowly they begin to corrupt what God ultimately intends for them. They begin to build an infrastructure that obscures each Jew's relationship to their Almighty. And as that gets bigger and bigger, and they become more and more wicked, like, keep in mind, they're not becoming wicked because necessarily they're like the pagans. They're becoming wicked because they're creating a false god. They're creating this false way of interacting as Jews. And God lets them get to a point and he says, look, you guys have been, I mean, this is the classic prophet stuff. Like, what you guys been doing? Like, you're supposed to be over here and you built all this stuff over here. I have to wipe this slate clean. Here come the Persians. Like, and so if we're going to talk about a beast, well, we borrow that analogy. We're not talking about the end times because then the beast would be brought low. If it was the end times, we were all faithful, then we'd be like, okay, God, you're going to wipe out the whole civilization because we're the faithful and it's all, but if you follow the analogy from the Old Testament, whatever evangelical Christianity has become needs to be wiped clean if Jack's right. I just wish you would have said it like that. Like, the point isn't the rise of the beast. The point is that evangelical Christianity has deformed the truth of the Bible to the point where God needs to start over. Will we be potentially enslaved or persecuted? Yeah, but man, that's kind of okay, right? I mean, like, what does that have to do with our soul? And what remarkable things for us to receive clarity. Persecution, I think we addressed this already. Persecution is remarkably clarifying. Because at some point when someone's like, you go vote for Obama, I'm going to kill you. I'm just going to vote for Obama. Like, I don't really care about Obama being in office. But if someone says, well, you're going to say the truth of the Bible is not true, I'm like, oh, no, that's a bigger deal. That's what I'm actually devoted my entire life to pursuing. So for me to deny that, that's a lot more complicated. So, part three, we're going to now go back to the culture war. When the bodies hit the floor, these are the casualties, as best as I can tell, of the culture war. There are myriads of casualties. There are individual casualties. There are systemic casualties. There are organizations that ultimately went the wrong direction. There are wonderful preachers who I believe in their sincerity who tripped up. And sometimes I trip up and I wonder if that's not for their own personal benefit. I don't know how God tells the story in all of our lives. I just know that for mine it was semi-messy, so I'm a little more comfortable with messy. The first and foremost is faith, as I described, is the idea that there's a part of evangelical Christianity and a definite part of the Republican Party pseudo-right that wanted to convince people that their decision to be Christians had been made by voting, by doing something simple, by not being an intellectual, whatever. So, and that's easy. In opposition to this other thing, it's easy to say. You're not them? Then you're cool. How complicated it is to be a Christian is not that complicated. There you go. You're all right. So that I think is the first and foremost casualty. The second casualty is the evangelical movement as in a socio-political sense. It was no longer politically expedient for the pseudo-right, the Republicans, to ally themselves with evangelicals. Ultimately, I have a suspicion we will see them flee that ship like the sinking ship like rats. Rats that I've always suspected politicians are. I mean, maybe you do too. But what we're seeing with that break of evangelical Republicans is you're going to see Republicans, I think they're going to be even worse. Like, I think you were lucky. Because the tenets of liberalism, if you look it up, is the idea of open, free society. Is this in theory, and if they're living up to their liberalism, they're defending nonconformists. They should, and I have the definition. Liberalism claims that a free society should not impose any specific code or behavior, which is why cultural evangelicals had such a problem with them, because they were perpetually trying to specify a code of behavior. Liberalisms do not want to impose a specified code of behavior, and ironically, its defense of the rights of nonconformists within society to express their own identity could potentially be useful for us now that the Republican Party might not think we're as cool. The scary part of the Republican Party is they were willing to do our bidding back in the culture war. They were willing to, for lack of a better phrase, impose specific codes of behavior. So I could imagine, politically speaking, that's what we're going to witness. We will have to size up. Who's going to want to take away freedoms from all people? And who's going to be more cool with us? Who's going to be cool in a liberal sense? Oh, it's unnerving to me, but that's just how it is, I guess. I put it down in paper. The conservative willingness, or the Republican willingness, to oppress their fellow Americans' freedoms and equalities makes them the greatest threat now to whatever possible religion that we all try to adhere to. Because they're going to go where the wind blows. Politicians always do. If that's the beast, fine. But I'm just saying, like, our old alliance is no longer broken, and it'll be interesting to see how things sort out, especially with regards to the Tea Party and how they are now being basically buried. So that's just interesting stuff to me. The power hungry will move against anyone that is politically expedient to do so. But it is the liberty of the left that has fought so hard to define, that has fought so hard to define itself against the evangelicals that should, I put in quotation, should, because, you know, I don't trust those people either, ultimately support our rights now. If they're not, they're not liberals, they're actually just Stalinists, and we'll have to fight them too. But we're not fighting anymore, remember? Okay. Number three, evangelicals themselves. This is a little about my generation and the evangelicals that grew up during the culture war, and in part what you guys are trying to solve for yourselves now. Evangelicals themselves, the individuals, have a difficult path ahead in this conflict. The better part of their demographics are bracing for the political blowback, which is doomed to come, in addition to contemplating what it means to be on the wrong side of the second civil rights movement, and whether it was right or wise for the anima of their political power to be justified by their interpretation of biblical truth. Some of you will head for the hills. Some of you will cave to social acceptable, and I think that was Jack's concern. I mirror and reflect that concern of just some people will go on in society and never take their commitment to truth and Bible that seriously. They'll just kind of, I'm over here now. This is very unpopular. I don't want to be unpopular. Whatever. And some will find a way to preserve their faith. And we'll get that. I'm promising that we'll get there. The final casualty, in my opinion, was the Bible itself. By co-opting the message of the Bible for its political means, evangelicals and the pseudo-right have made a weapon of Jesus and his message. And I'm going to read from our friend Pat Buchanan from 1992 Republican National Convention. This is one of the least offensive quotes I could find of his. The Bill and Hillary Clinton agenda would impose on America abortion on demand, a litmus test for the Supreme Court, homosexual rights, discrimination against religious schools, women in combat. That's change, all right, but it's not the kind of change America wants. It's not the kinds of change that America needs. It's not the kind of change that we can tolerate in a nation that we still call God's country. Now, I'm sympathetic to him, but he lost, and that's why he lost. He just explained why he lost. Because the change was actually, that was the change that we were going toward. Now, is that change? I'm not saying that change is good or bad. Like, in many ways, there's an element of what he's describing here that I'm horrified by. Like, I share his horror. I don't share his method. But again, you can hear how the tension between this is the land of the free, this is about equality, and you hear that speech, 1992. You must see how this terrifies other people who are not Pat Buchanan. I mean, I'm going to go talk about my generation, and you must see that the orphans of the culture war, as I've described them, saw this as terrifying. Anybody who couldn't conform to what he's describing understood what he was doing. He uses the word cannot tolerate. I mean, like, well, I don't know where we get the word intolerance from, but it's weird that he even used that word. And so I know a lot of you are doing some breathing exercise to calm down. I just want to say that the idea that Jesus would be perpetually allied with the Republican side, that he took sides at all in the conflict, is interesting. And that's why Tim Tebow is getting crap. I think Tim Tebow could very much have a saving faith. He could be working out his relationship with his God every day. And in many ways, I totally understand why Jack believes he's admirable. He could very well be admirable. If he's not doing it for the name of goodness, if he's not doing it for social status amongst the superior class, if he's doing it out of a sincere yearning of saying, man, I'm here, I feel very lucky, I just want to tell people how glad I am that God got me here. If he's doing that, God bless that man. Unfortunately, he's basically flashing a gang sign of political oppression at the same time. Why is that the case? Because of the culture war. And we can't not see that at the same time. We can admire Tim Tebow, but if we ignore the fact that for 30 years a culture war has taken place and there were people who were perpetually pushed into extremes, and when Tim Tebow does that, he's not doing it transcending culture. He's in a culture, and that is a political move he did. Whether he likes it or not, I'd love to talk to the man. I probably could size up. I mean, he's a football player, so I don't know if he talks. But in theory, I played football, so I'm allowed to make that joke. From 5 to 17, football the whole time. And I was good. So keep in mind, the orphans of the culture war have inherited the conflict. We've inherited the ruins of it. We've inherited a worldview that has no semblance of partisan sides. We have to make this up. And oftentimes we have to make this up in the sense of experimentation. We have to go out and do it. That's why we look so wishy-washy. That's why sexual promiscuity seems so appalling. It's because we were not given something that explained what sexual purity looks like, so we have to go invent it. You guys didn't give us SH, nothing personal. Because why? Because we couldn't allow, no one would let us into the right side. No, the political agenda of the right and the evangelical political orthodoxy moralizing, that didn't include people who were complicated or fumbly or parents left or dad left at 17. So the messiness of my generation couldn't find purchase in either place. We are left-leaning because they're more permissive, and we feel like to understand our world, we need to go out and go and experience things and be permissive. Like I'm not joking. I have friends who literally will go, it's almost like you could break apart their life into decades of experimentation. They'll do 10 years of drug experimentation to find out if that's what they are. Am I that? And then they'll do 10 years of sexual experimentation. Am I this? Oftentimes they'll do all these things at the same time. Like, is there an earnestness there? Sure. Well, if we say there's not an earnestness, then Jack's right and we should all go to the hills. But what if this culture that's coming into being is serious about something? About finding out who they are, which seems very human. It seems like God's done that on purpose. He doesn't allow us to be automatons. He wants us to discover ourselves and our Creator. And those who are sanctified, you don't even know what they look like. Like, if you are still fighting the culture war, you will never see who's sanctified. You will never see that person who has metal in their face and is pretty much probably bisexual. You will never see if that person's actually going toward God. You will never see it. If you're culture warring, you don't have a chance. another reason why I don't like the culture war. So you have to recognize that our generation, in some ways, will recount stories of intolerance in the way that African Americans recount stories of intolerance from the 50s. The culture war was that divisive, was that insidious. Like, and I have it from both sides. I mean, I'm weird enough that the progressives are just as insidious with respect to chastising you for not holding the party line. I'm pointing fingers both directions. There's this quote by General Patton. I have to work Patton in all my stories. But it's from the movie. It was attributed to him. It's not actually him, but it was this idea that if Patton ever found himself surrounded by the Russians and the Germans, he would divide his army in half and attack in both directions. I feel like that's what we got to do as people with faith. Is like, yeah, you got to go both directions. Like, there's an insidiousness over here. There's an insidiousness over there. But I still voted for Obama, so you can judge me for that, I guess. But Bush twice. I feel like I evened it out. So yeah, you have to understand that our generation is one that experienced intolerance on behalf of this war, and it put us between our God. It makes aligning with Jesus and the Bible a lot more complicated. What Jack is right. Jack is right. Jack is saying this new culture, they're not coming to Christ, and we're not coming to Christ because we can't be evangelical Republicans, and we don't like going to that convention. And every time the Republicans have the convention, it looks scary to us. So I don't know if I've explained this sufficiently, but I need to move on because I need to move on. I want to, I don't know if you guys know about this email thing. I'll email with any of you. Any of you guys have questions, I will email with you. We will talk this to the death. And you can email that you hate me. I'm still cool. I get that every day. So I work for social services. You have no idea. I don't feel the pressure to get everything in there. I want to quickly, I get to read a rap guy. And so think of the Pat Buchanan thing. And I'm going to read a rap guy. This poem's called Same Love. It's a gay marriage advocate poem, rap. Some of you like art, some of you don't. I want to read it because I feel like two things are happening here that I think are really, really useful. It starts, when I was in the third grade, I thought that I was gay. Because I could draw, my uncle was, and I kept my room straight. I told my mom, tears rushing down my face, and she said, Ben, you've loved girls since you were pre-K. Tripping. Yeah, I guess she had a point, didn't she? A bunch of stereotypes all in my head. Remember doing the math? Like, yeah, I'm good at Little League. A preconceived idea of what it all meant. For those who like the same sex, had the same characteristics, the right-wing conservatives think it's a decision. You can be cured with some treatment and religion. The man-made rewiring of a predisposition playing God. Here we go. America the brave still fears what we don't know. And God loves all of his children, but somehow forgotten, as we paraphrase a book written 3,500 years ago. He then goes on. We press play. We don't press pause. Progress marches on with a veil over our eyes. We turn our back on the cause. Till the day my uncles can be united by law. Kids walking around the hallway, plagued by pain in their heart. World so hateful some would rather die than be who they are. And a certificate on paper isn't going to solve it all, but it's a damn good place to start. No law is going to change us. We have to change us. Whatever God you believe in, we come from the same one. Strip away the fear. Underneath, it's the same love. It's about time that we raise up. Now, I wrote in my little notes here, it took a white rapper from Seattle about 5 minutes to completely destroy 30 years of the Christian Coalition's work. And he's basically the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Now, I know there's two opinions that you can have about him. One, you have the opinion that, man, he has a lot of friends who are hurt. He has a lot of friends that are really struggling through this country and through understanding who they are. Or you could just say that's propaganda. Just be like, oh, that's the left propaganda. That's making it attractive. That's making it interesting. Let's put the branch of acceptance on it. Whether you like it or not, that's a really good argument here. And what I mean by good is not what you mean. I mean, it's just a good argument. If you still want to fight the culture war, you still got to address this. And it looks really good to me. Well, let's address it also at the same time. When I was in third grade, I thought that I was gay. Well, that's where we can be useful. If you want to apply your culture war energies to something, and I'll talk about this at the very end. I think David talked about this. What my generation could use would be clarity. Like, if you believe in God and have a faith about a clarity about your faith, you understand what you're doing, we could use that. My generation has no clarity. We have to sort out our clarity by ourselves. It's kind of like, well, am I this? Oh, I guess I'm not gay. I tried that. Oh, should I be a druggie? Let's see if I'm good with money. Not good with money. I shouldn't be a druggie. So we're sorting out our identities in a way that's totally foreign to you all because apparently you guys got your identity stamped from your parents or something. I don't know. David, I missed David's talk. It would have been useful for me to know. I don't know where you guys got yours. There's a political alliance. I guess maybe it's political. I have no idea. You probably could tell me. You could tell me how ultimately culturally you came to your conclusions. If you could imagine not having a culture or having a culture that was remarkably freefall, where you could be evangelical Christian one day and then a gay activist the next day, or maybe both at the same time, you would understand what my generation is doing. So if you want to still throw us under the bus for not being evangelicals, you can, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Like, we would love actually a conversation on how you ended up staying married for so long. Like, that's the heartbreaking part. Like, the heartbreaking part is, it's not, I see my friends marry and they have no idea what they're doing, but they really want it to work. They want to understand what they're doing. No one wants to fumble through life totally without an identity, totally without definitions, totally without values. People want to understand. It'd be nice if we got some help from people who have been married for 40 years, 50 plus years. It'd be nice. My Gutenberg experience, I lucked out. I was reading a quote book, which is my introduction to Great Thoughts was a quote book I was reading, and I realized that I immediately liked Dostoevsky, Voltaire, and Nietzsche almost immediately. And why? Because they were critical of the evangelical Christianity that I was raised in. And my sister sent out brochures to schools in Eugene and got one back from Gutenberg and walked into my room. I'll never forget the day. She just threw the brochure at me. I opened it up. On the bottom of the brochure, they had listed authors that they read, and they mentioned Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, and Voltaire. And I went, okay, I'll go there. Like, I mean, again, when we talk about sanctification, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the idea that I could have labored in an absolute... I know my heart. I love my God. Like, I am trying to figure this out so freaking badly. And God threw me a bone. God gave me an opportunity to sit next to men who had actually done the hard work of theology that I could have never got to on my own, being a kid from Los Angeles, not being the brightest student. I was a football player. And God allowed me to go to a school where I sat beneath men who were teaching me about a religion that my father used against me. Like, man, I think my closing argument, it's a good place to put my closing arguments, and it's 5 pages long, I'm just kidding. I think I admire Jack for putting his courage, for being courageous to put his intellectual ideas out there. I think that's the very thing that has made his faith so powerful to me. It's the opposite of evangelicalness. It's the ability to address new ideas. It's the ability to dialogue about new things. And so he did it again, this thing. It's remarkable. You just, somebody else, I forget, he was over there. He mentioned it. Like, what a weird thing in our society that someone says, hey, I believe this stuff. Does anybody want to make fun of me for it? And like, in a sense of dialogue, in a sense of like, what do you think? What are we doing? Let's talk about this. Like, that's why Gutenberg has been the best thing in the world. That's why I feel like I still have faith, was that the professors allowed me that amount of play. They didn't mind that I cussed. Stuff like that. So my closing argument, I suppose, is one addressing Jack really quickly. And it's why the analogy of the beast is an inadvertently hostile and overly simplistic method for understanding the world. The analogy of beasts encourages fear of those not like us. They are not dynamic creations of God. They are evil puppets secretly unified in a contra-biblicism conspiracy led by a Lord Sauron-like power. 2, the analogy of the beast makes unloving behavior toward others seem righteous. 3, the analogy of the beast does not allow for self-criticism. It blames the other party as if they acted independent of anything we have done. They hate us because we are good. 4, the analogy of the beast can be used propagandistically. It can inspire a sort of passionate hatred entirely devoid of rational accountability and introspection. And that sounds a lot like the work of the superior class. I do not think Jack is doing that, but I'm just saying that's why I don't like the phrase. The analogy of the beast can be used to mask bigotry. It can be used as a spiritual and religious slur, similar to how Satan was used amongst the Puritans and in the 19th century and how heretic was used in the Middle Ages. The analogy of the beast does not take into account the cultural differences of individuals nor the universal human crappiness of everybody. The analogy of the beast automatically assumes that the employer of the analogy is on the non-beast side. The analogy of the beast, when applied to elements of American popular culture, muddies the singular importance of intellectual commitment to the Bible. You mean I have to make the leap Uncle Kierkegaard describes and burn all my Beatles albums? Man, heaven better be really great. The analogy of the beast, when used outside the epistemological context, makes us sound like loonies. Now, this is my last point is one specifically for where I want Jack to score against me. I want him to win. But my point 9 leads to, I can hear Jack being like, well, shouldn't we care? I mean, shouldn't we allow ourselves to be ridiculed for our faith? I'm totally cool with that. However, I mean, the beast has always made coolness a sneering weapon against the unhip truth seeker. However, I would caution that here to be unhip is not a virtue in itself. To engage in our culture means in some sort speaking the lingo. It means some sort getting dirty. The faith does not require someone who believes the world is round to talk as if it's flat. Nor should our assistance on hipness be an obstacle to another person hearing the good news. There are three opinions about how we progress through this, as I highlighted the traditionalist one, which is more of a fortress mentality. The evangelicals, who are now questioning whether that was a good idea by fighting to the death culturally. I'm going to make an argument that we ultimately, as evangelicals, simply need to come back to faith. To address the fortress one, to withdraw from our culture is to betray the crucifixion of Jesus. God asked Jesus to die for the sins of the world, and you don't have faith to send your kids to public schools? I know I'm simplifying, but I cannot conceive of why those who have the good news would not just remain silent, but would flee the city. There are many different kinds of bushels, and I would warn you against that, but mostly they are either fear or arrogance. By neglecting your duty to us and abandoning us to confusion. I'm going to use the Bible now. The interpretation I received in school, or in church, about Lot, we all know the story of Lot, Lot's in Sodom. The overwhelming interpretation of that, and I've just invented the one that I like now, is it is a shaming of Lot. Everyone reads that section and says, Lot is in the wrong side of the town. Lot should not be in Sodom. What are you doing, Lot? God's about to wipe out Sodom, and you're in Sodom? That is not the dialogue, from what I can tell, that follows. The dialogue that follows is, I think it's Abraham, right, who's questioning? Lot's Abraham, I think that's right. Is the character questioning God very slyly, because God doesn't see through him. So if there's like one guy in Sodom who's like kind of cool, like, would you still wipe all of them out? And God goes, no. And okay, that's cool. Like, well, what if there's like, you know, or no, it starts at like 100 guys. If there's 100 cool guys in Sodom, would you wipe Sodom out? God's like, no, leave you, okay. And they go, well, okay, what if it's 50? God's like, no, I'd leave Sodom alone, that's fine. What about 20? And like, the interpretation of Lot is that Lot shouldn't have been there, and he was lucky God saved his ass. Pardon my French. The interpretation I actually think is right is that what confidence we can take in being in our culture. That if one of you is amongst a society, God will spare it. And that's really meaningful. That's the anti-fortress mentality. Like, that if one of you with faith is living amongst a whole population of secular heathens, that God will consider that. That God will say, well, we'll stave that off. I mean, in some sense, when I think of Moses hitting the rock, I feel that same dynamic. I understand that it's really complicated, but I feel that same dynamic. Like, it wasn't part of what Moses did was linguistically he took a lot of credit for something, but he also separated himself from his culture. And I get the Jews, man. I would want to separate those people. Seem whiny, but that's what he did. I mean, part of the rebuke must have been him finally stepping away and going, ah, you guys are over here, I'm over here, like ah. So, I think I made my point with that sound. I just ground it out. So, I think fighting is obviously not working for us, politically speaking. We're not going to change our culture. The rap guy just beat Pat Buchanan like 100 times over. You could read the whole thing. It's an amazing video, too. Like, that argumentation is in line with why America is a good country. Not necessarily that it's a righteous country, but it's a great country. What we must do, I'm going to make an argument for at the end of the day, we need to denounce the superior class of evangelical Christianity as it has existed. We need to come back to the faith of being true evangelicals. I don't think we should rename ourselves. I don't think we should become post-evangelicals or contra-evangelicals. I think, ironically, part of what we need to do is keep the name. I think if you want to teach my generation about the faith of the Bible, you should first introduce yourself as evangelical, and then you should apologize for the culture war. I think you should apologize for 30 years of un-American policies and legislation. And in doing so, what a remarkable thing you have done for their perception of the Bible. Like, and this is not a manipulation of ploy. I know we have a car salesman mentality on the evangelical side with respect to God. I'm saying simply that don't you dare say you're not an evangelical if you've been an evangelical for this long, but just apologize now. What will the apology do? I ultimately think the apology will allow the person talking to you to have greater clarity about what it means to stand for the Bible. And actually, you might actually be persecuted for something that matters, opposed to all the trivial crap that most of you have been persecuted for. What's nice is, like what Ron says, is that the beast cannot restrict the power of the faithful. I like my Lot analogy. It is actually the other way around. It is because of our faith that we are allowed to move freely and engage our culture. It is we are faithful, and so we can go into the world and we can mix it up. We can talk to people of different cultures and persuasions and sexual orientations. It's not going to jump on us. We're not going to become codified by them. Our kids will not be seduced by them. And in some ways, our kids have their own narrative. And that's easy for me to say because my kids, I can put in a crib and it doesn't go anywhere. But, so I get that. I will see how well my faith works that one out. So like, in some sense, we don't have to actually fear the lies of the beast or his seductions. I mean, when we have clarity of our faith, when we really grasp, and this, again, thanks to Jack, my experience at Gutenberg, and again, if I was sanctified, I still would have come to conclusions. I probably should have come to him at 75, and I've had to make 20,000 terrible mistakes, and I'd have to ask for a lot different kinds of grace than I already have to ask for. But the clarity of faith is the armor that we need. We're not going to change the culture. I don't want to get all evangelical in the old sense. Like, that whose goal was that? I don't know why that was the goal. The goal should ultimately be that in the end, you trust your God enough that he'll walk people right to you. And I have this experience a million times a day, and I hope you have it too. If you don't, maybe you should question some things. But I work at a state office, and I swear, there are people that come to my office for no other reason that God had sent them to me. There are times I bring up my Bible. I bring up my Bible to my coworkers, and they scratch their head like, why is this person, doesn't he know he's not supposed to talk about God in a state office? But that's my thing. It's like, culture war, you're not going to win it. But we've all had the experience of, in our darkest moments or in our most confused moments, God brings somebody along who knew. So, the culture war is over. I think we should be joyful. I think we should be joyful because we no longer have to deify the Republican Party. I think it's nice because we can finally stand for the truth of the Bible as an intellectual commitment, as a beautiful expression of the work that God's doing, and might enjoy the actual sting of being persecuted for that thing that actually matters. Like, I think that the Bible is the best response to all of humanity's aches. I think the Bible is right. I think it makes us the most human, no matter what Nietzsche says. I think it's the full package, though. I think it's spiritual. I think it's intellectual. I think it's artistic. I think when we think of God's working in us, he's working in individuals, and those individuals are remarkably diverse and have remarkably wonderful stories. And that's what makes God amazing. That's what the essence of faith is about. I think we can be joyful because we can enjoy the humility that is antithetical to capitalism, materialism, and a part of American bravado that I don't think is actually makes any sense. Not for someone who is supposed to be a servant. I'm not going to bring up the new pope, but if the new pope came to town, I would go see him. His emphasis on the poor, on service, on moving away from the bureaucratic infrastructure of his messages. He's going to slums. I haven't seen a pope go to slums in generations. And why does that resonate with me? Because that's where the Bible should be going. Like, in a society that is remarkably about status and the superior class, of course the Bible should be going to the slums. Of course the Bible should be going to those who are ideologically confused. I just don't know why it's not as obvious as it is on my paper. So I guess in a sense, be joyful because a new generation is now ready to hear a truth that they have never heard spoken. And that's it. Thank you.
Toby, if you think you get any sympathy by having your son...
It was my wife's idea. She's like, here, you can just take this kid. They'll be nicer to you. I'm like, oh, good point. I'm just going to defer to him if I don't like the questions. This will be for my friend here.
Well, Toby, I had the last word the other night and get the first one. And as you know,
yes.
I've told you this before, you were one of the significant... reasons that we got turned on to Gutenberg back whatever it was 15 years ago, whenever you were a freshman.
Yeah.
And your talk, I absolutely loved it. Great talk. Very, you know, very, very well done. It'll be one of the first ones I want to go back and listen to.
Thank you.
Should I say but now?
You can do it. Actually,
there is no but. I have a question for you, or a couple of questions, because the evangelicalism that you describe is the evangelicalism that I rejected 45 years ago. I mean, I can remember sitting in the Anaheim Convention Center hearing Bob Schuller of the Crystal Cathedral explain to us the reasons that Christianity was equated with anti-communism. I can remember that as a 14-year-old and saying, this doesn't fit. So the evangelicalism that is equated with a political movement is something that I rejected a long time ago. So I wonder sometimes if, or from some of your presentation, if, I mean, the evangelicalism you described is one that I would reject also. But my question or my observations, there are a couple of things that you said in your talk that were helpful for me, maybe insightful, maybe I missed the point. Helpful for me in, at one point you were talking about Jack's interpreting the culture through the book of Revelation, and I mean, yeah, that maybe was a part of his project here. You made an observation, I thought, about you interpreting it through your culture or your generational lens rather than your cultural lens, and or rather than a biblical lens. And I don't know if it's either or, but I thought about that. And then later on, you talked about a culture being in free fall. You made the observation that your generation would love to have a conversation with us. My observation is simply that I wish I believed that. I wish I believed, and that's stating it too harshly, so I apologize for that. But when you say that your generation wants to have a dialogue with us, that's where I'm missing it. Because now I'm not one of the tutors. I don't have that sort of prominent role. But, I mean, other than my kids sometimes hinting at it, sometimes asking about it a little bit, nobody's ever asked me what it takes to be married for 35 years. Nobody has ever asked me, other than, again, some family members, nieces and nephews, nobody has ever asked me, well, tell me what you think about what the Bible says about homosexuality. Tell me what you think about what the Bible says about abortion. And so for me, that's the missing piece, is I want to believe that we can have a dialogue, but the impression that I have is that and I can't generalize to all the tutors, but is that I have been written off as that evangelical that you are, you know, that you're talking about there, and that your generation, if we can generalize, really is not interested in gaining any wisdom, any thoughts from me, and really is not that interested in what I think the scriptures have to say about these issues. That's where, if there's a disjuncture there, I mean, I can understand you're saying that you don't feel as though there's much dialogue going on. From my perspective, it's kind of a two-way street, and I don't experience your generation really being that interested in what those of us who get set aside as old white evangelicals have to say.
What I think is interesting is, it sounds like you have a lot of hurt. It's like,
well,
it sounds
there,
like you're hurt.
If we're talking about, I mean, to get very personal, if we're talking about hurt from, for example, from you.
No. I've heard you plenty of times. But, I mean, like, in another way. It sounds like you're hurt. It sounds like when you describe being a white male, it sounds like something's hurt you. Like something, you're taking something remarkably personal, and it sounds like you feel rejected.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, okay. is there the belief that in our generation we're not hip enough, we don't get it, we're not adequately informed by our culture, we don't really understand? I mean, if that's what you mean by rejection.
Sure.
Well, sure, yeah. There's clearly that that intimation that we just don't get it.
I don't know necessarily what to do. I mean, Jack kind of highlighted an element of this idea that I don't know if he would correlate the two, but But Jack also describes a feeling of how something about the culture that he was raised that he can't help but feel inferior. His decisions to be a philosopher and theologian. Oh, you're a theologian too? You're not really a thinker if you're a theologian. Like, there's an element of as we love on this earth and pursue our faith, we will encounter bias. And I would never look at anyone and say there isn't an ageist element to all generational struggles. Like, didn't you guys have like, don't trust anybody over 40, 50? I forget your little slogan. You had some slogan. So in some sense, you guys were probably a little shorter. You guys cut it real short. So in some sense, I'm sorry that you're hurt. I'm sorry you feel rejected. If you could imagine why you didn't trust the previous generation when you were 15, 17, 22, you could imagine what that person could do, what that person could have done to surprise you. And that's the best answer I can give you or the best compliment I could offer you.
And that really is helpful.
Sure.
For me, I didn't distrust the generation before me. I didn't believe everything that they said. I didn't agree with everything that I said. But I didn't go into it distrusting them.
Then you'll need a remarkably good imagination. You'll need to begin to imagine things that you had no experience of. Being sorting out your identity without that mistrust. You apparently had trust for your previous old elders and your, that's fine. You can start there. If you want to imagine what it's like being here in the next generation's shoes, it's that in some ways we judge people on their merit. And we will have a bias against somebody who looks like evangelical, old white man. Sure, I see why you're hurt there. I am sorry. But in regards to you approaching, if you have a heart for the new generation and it's a heart that is to benefit them and not make them like you, you'll find a way. That love will take you there. And I have a suspicion that God does that all the time. Like, that's the best I got for you. Go.
Some of your personal background you shared, I share.
Mm-hmm.
Your thinking, which is like bowled out of a gun. I experienced that too. I admire you for being able to catch those thoughts and put them in a relatively understandable fashion.
You're being very charitable. Yes, okay.
No. And have the courage, which I lack, especially at your age, to expose yourself for this group. That's why I'm hugging you, because I love you, Toby.
Okay, yeah, no, we get it. I know you love it.
Listening to you is like going to a fireworks show, though.
Yeah, I watched you flinch several times.
There are these bright lights of truth that just explode in my face, and then there's all this health-threatening noise accompanied by toxic air pollution that it's part of the show.
That's pretty charitable.
I think I have... I'm a little confused between the response to Jack's paper as being a spiritual interpretation of our experience and yours is a political interpretation of our experience.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a disconnect for me there.
All big time.
Comments like he portrays the battle in culture and history as spiritual, whereas you portray it as, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
The Bible portrays it as that. Whether you can disagree on the timing, but it is a matter of God-given values that the world hates. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one, Paul says. It is not our... We could be as Christian as the day is long in purity and biblicalism, and Paul says that they will call you a fool. And because it is not our culture that makes us a fool, is Christ that makes us a fool. So however we manifest that, whether we do it 100% well or 80% or barely get a passing grade at all, they're going to look at us and say, you're a fool. And worse, history has shown that we will eventually not be called a fool, we will be called an enemy of the state. And I think that's part of what Jack is addressing in his paper is that as God you could say, brings persecution and purifies his people through it, the succeeding culture, the one with the power, in this case political power, economic power, social power, is going to seek us out to identify us, as they did the Jews, for their religion in Nazi Germany.
Sure.
And you're working in a state office where it's going to happen to you for what you're doing. I mean, it's kind of funny. So I'm sort of caught between the disconnect of responding to his spiritual impression of the version in the Bible and your regarding it in political terms, which more seemed to become very, very, very personal towards the end, in that it was our generation, our hurt, our identity, our experimentation, none of which is political. It's all personal.
Okay.
And it's all based on values.
Okay.
And so I'm just a little, and I'm kind of like Peter too. My identity was not given to me. Uh-huh. It wasn't stamped on me by the previous generation. I myself have had to work through that, decide who I am, still doing it, mm-hmm. right? But I grudgingly, and this was tough for me in my 20s, admitted that the generation before me has an advantage in this argument. You know what that is?
No, at this point I don't.
It's a God-given advantage.
They're white?
No, they're old.
Oh, they're old.
They're old.
Well, it's funny, one of my favorite
quotes. And they have mileage, and they had experience, uh-huh. and they have hard, cold reality.
Sure.
And they have seen the bodies along the road. You know, they've the fool that thought he could fly, and they, guy's got no legs now. Yeah. They learn from the fool. So they don't revisit these ideas. They say, let me tell you what I learned from the fool.
Sure.
They don't consult the map every time they make a response to you.
Yeah. So where are we in this question?
My question, the question would be, how do you grant them...
Them being?
The generation before.
Okay, the old ones?
The older.
Older.
I'm almost twice your age. I mean, I got to be careful here.
That's true.
How do you grant them the value?
The value.
And the importance of that God-given advantage in this conversation. When they can say, trust me, I've been there, we should trust them they've been there. Now, Grant, we can ask them to unpack that.
Sure.
Were you really there?
My favorite quotes is, the devil knows more from being old than from being a devil.
Yeah.
So, no. No. No, in the sense of no. Like, I think any rational person who doesn't want to, who wants to critically think about something, takes people on their merit individually. I don't get it. Like, old people have some sort of advantage.
I'm saying they have an advantage in this way.
What way?
My dad could look at me and say,
"Old?
Yeah.
No.
They have mileage.
I've met fools who are old all the time.
I have too.
So what are we talking about?
I'm saying when I look at I'll give my own father for example. His famous quote was, do I get any credit for my experience?
Well, it depends if he was an idiot or not.
It depends on what his experience was, right?
I guess I'm just so confused.
So if my dad remained debt-free, never spent a day in jail, never cheated on his wife, kept a roof over our head
You're
and threw it on
values,
a table.
Or, you know that, right? Really shallow values.
Never gave me a bad word of advice about how to live my life morally. Value-wise, was not a teaching...
You're very lucky to have that dad. He sounds great.
Millions of people my age had that experience.
That's wonderful. That's exciting.
And I think sometimes when they produce something culturally, legislatively, they don't need to consult the map again because they've been there and came back.
Well, you just made a move there I don't like, but you can keep going.
Well, I'm saying, and it's like, I think I hear myself defending my father's...
It does sound like that.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? On an individual basis, I have to approach them as individuals.
Sure.
I can't say them, that generation, they...
Sure.
And I have to understand the things they do that I would do differently, they do it for very good reasons.
Okay.
And that could be culturally and even legislatively. They're going to look at me and say, trust me, kid, that doesn't work. Trust me, kid, that's not a new idea. That's an old idea that was rejected long ago. And trust me, just because it's new doesn't mean it's good. And that's what we have to look at. Is it good?
Yeah.
Or is it not good? Not whether it's new or old.
Yeah. Or that your dad likes it or not likes it.
So work with me on giving them a break.
Ooh.
Talk to me about them. The them you talk about, the previous generation, the old white guys.
Why would we give them a break because they're old and white? I'm still confused.
No, I'm saying because of what I just said.
Oh, about the wisdom
work with
thing
me on
or the tradition
how could
thing?
We find a way to give them a break?
If those people are perpetuating anything other than a commitment to the values of the Bible, I don't see what the heck. No, let me catch myself. No, I don't get it, man. I can't help you out. I could no more tell you to value your pops for valuing some guy you meet on the street with nose piercings. Like, your entire way of approaching this problem is so foreign to me. I can't help you, and we probably should just talk later about it because I don't get it.
Okay. Okay.
Cool.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. I do relate to your talk about wanting to connect with your generation from my generation.
Mm-hmm.
And about the first step would have to be taking responsibility for the stuff that I've been taught and tried to push on to my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to say, I'm sorry, Toby.
Well, yeah,
I'm
not your kids. You don't have to apologize to me. I mean, as long as your kids are hearing this from you, I assume you guys are working it out.
I have said sorry, but I'm saying to your generation, going forward, if I want the substance of my faith to come through,
sure.
I'm going to want to make that first connection by taking responsibility and saying, I'm sorry for some of this stuff. Not everybody's. I mean, it is personal.
Sure.
But I want to be able to say to you, you know, or to your generation,
sure.
I'm sorry. That's a starting point.
Yeah.
If I can't say that.
You're kind of in a form of arrested development. You've stopped.
Yeah, it stops. It stops right there.
Well, what's remarkable is once you say you're sorry, you realize there's so much more for you to do. Because
exactly. Because
unpacking what you guys have experienced is just as meaningful to us and witnessing you guys unpack, man, I was a part of the culture war. This is what it looked like. This is why we thought this was important. Like, I could just as well have imagined an individual who was a staunch culture warrior, dyed in the wool, who has that kind of come to Jesus moment or this moment of reflection where as he begins to then unpack, well, how much does environmentalism, shouldn't my views reflect? I like the earth. I should probably, well, these as we change, as we mature through our faith, that is more than powerful enough. I mean, and apologies are good, but also processing is best. I mean, what Jack and Ron and David have left me privy to is their development before their God.
Yes.
And, like, then you see, like, I mean, I know that I'm trying to head off several thousand questions about how do I talk to this generation. I mean, when I say is come back to faith, I mean, as what is more remarkable than watching someone in the late stage of their life continue to invent revolutionary ideas, continuing to go, oh my goodness, I thought this forever and now I don't. I love my mom. My mom's pacing is very slow. My dad left at 17. She has her own business. She's classic, like, bootstrap kind of a gal. I love her so much. She's not super good at other things, emotional necessarily, but she's wonderful in all these ways. And watching her turn a quarter, she'll come over and she'll be like, well, this is an example. When we were growing up, she's like, you know, if you guys get tattoos, you guys are going to hell. I mean, straight off the bat. I'm like, tattoos, huh? Tattoos? That's what you picked was tattoos? And so we, of course, go out and get tattoos. And she's like, wow, well, I didn't really mean it. Like, and, like, it's that part of her where every time the loving part of her came in conflict with what the conservative Christian culture said, and after the divorce, she believed that she was going to hell because of a certain version of how they interpret the Bible and that she thought she'd never get married again. Every time her heart came in conflict with the evangelical culture around her, and I'm sure this is many of your guys' experience, she always sided with what God was doing in her. She always would be like, all right, fine, you can get tattoos. Like, so I hear what you're saying. As you continue to develop, that will be more than rewarding for I would imagine being very lucky to be the child of parents, two parents who are both perpetually changing and doing surprising new innovative things.
Yeah. It's the humility, isn't it? God will use that humility.
Very
God
much
will
so.
Do it.
Humility
now,
is
what do I do
really
with this
good.
Thing?
I wanted to ask a question. I was intrigued about what you said about concerning Lot.
Yes.
And that whole event. It sounded to me like you were saying that there's something very, very special about Lot being in Sodom.
Yes.
And God working through Lot, although I suppose if we analyze that situation today, it would look very much like what Jack was describing. That's pretty hopeless.
Yeah, he's not turning Sodom around. It has that name for a reason.
That's right. It doesn't look like Sodom's going any other direction, yeah. but the direction it was going. And yet, the argument that Abraham put forward was, well, what about if there's 100? What about if there's 50?
Yeah.
And it's like God is saying, it doesn't take very many, and I have a reason for Lot being there, and I'm engaged thoroughly with Lot. He is not going to be corrupted by this, but now it's at a point where I've made a decision that Sodom's going to go. So I found that to be very encouraging to me personally, just to think about Lot being there in that environment, and somehow there was a reason for that. I can't imagine what it was, but it just encouraged me in a way. It reminded me of Ron's talk.
Yeah.
God is faithful. He will see me through this. He will give me the wisdom and the clarity and the insight to know what to do. And when God calls me to leave, it's time to leave.
Uh-huh.
And they face what they're going to face. But anyhow, that just intrigued me, and I want to thank you for bringing that up.
I appreciate you saying that. I have that passage came to me as I was writing this.
Yeah.
Let's remember too that Lot's faithfulness to God came at a cost because his wife looked bad. Like,
okay.
What's stunning about that whole narrative is that Lot is in Sodom. We don't know if Lot's doing culture-changing stuff. Lot's probably just doing business. Like, he probably has a job. He probably goes about it. And God says, okay, we have the one guy there. That guy was protected. That guy's heart was not changed. And a lot of what the culture war was about was somehow protecting our children from this other influence. But Lot was faithful, and he still lost his wife. She turned into salt. Like, and that's... that's for God to decide. That's the mercy we ask for, my God. I have 3 children. I love them all. And you want to see them know how great it is to know their God. But that is not my decision. Yet.
Well, I just want to make sure I understood where you were going with that.
Yeah.
And also
to promote a sort of fearlessness. I mean, like, if your faith is clear, and again, I have the benefit of sitting amongst professors who taught me a faith that is clear. I mean, I could explain a story to you that would be about how much my faith has been tested. But if your faith is clear, then go into the world. Go mix it up. Like, you're not going to be seduced by the beast. Every time the beast does something, you're going to be like, oh, that's creepy. Hey, does this look creepy to you guys? And one person hopefully will be like, yeah, that does strike me as creepy too. Mm-hmm. And you'll have a conversation.
Okay, I mentioned yesterday about dropping my son off at UCLA.
Yeah, very brave.
Thank you. So the past 4 years of teaching high school students through Sunday school, I had a very interesting experience. It's a church that is a Southern Baptist, I think by origin, but they don't really mention what really their denomination is. I mentioned it's a Korean church, and it's actually quite large in some ways, not as large as some in Korea, but it's about 2,500 people in the congregation. What was interesting is, being a very large church, they have a pastor for high school, but a pastor for junior high school, pastor for elementary. And the high school pastor, whom I, in some essence was, sort of over me, because he had some things to say to me as a teacher, and explained that, you know, he really wanted us teachers, there were 12 of us, Bible, English. But and each time, whenever we actually picked a book from the Bible, the pastor was against it. He then would push a kind of a popular book, Christian book, and each time I didn't care for it. So each time I ended up saying, "Oh, I'm not crazy about this. I'm very sorry, but we started the Book of Mark. I think we're doing pretty good." So the kids seemed to like it, and so he backed off a little bit, and And then it happened again and again each year. And the last year, he really wanted us to teach this one material that I couldn't even open because I knew enough about it that I just didn't feel comfortable. So I decided we were going to do the book of Hebrews. And, you know, pretty much everybody, the parents and others were all saying, isn't that too difficult a book for these kids? And I said, yes, it is. I have no idea what I'm doing either. But I think this is what I'm going to open up, at least, just so that the kids would have a chance. Because most of my kids don't open the Bible at home. They get to read the Bible with me for 30 minutes a week. And so, by then, this pastor was very ticked at me. And so finally, I did ask him, you know, I believe in your authority over me here in this position. And I feel you're welcome to fire me. And he didn't. So I ended up actually being with the students all the way through. So we read through Hebrews, and then we read through. We started working on Genesis, and this one we walked through slower. And what I have to mention is that these are high school kids. I'm 40-some-year-old woman, and these kids are cool, and I am not. I have no idea what that even means. My children laugh at me all the time because I don't get it. Yeah. But I mean, I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do about that. Yeah. But, you know, every time I crack open the Bible, they seem to like it. And that was what was amazing. Even though they're not reading it at home and they're not really saying anything about it, you know, the thank you notes I got at the end of the year was all about you are the most fabulous Bible teacher. And, you know, I have to tell you, very honestly, I mean, I don't know the Bible as well as I ought. Oh, my goodness. And I'm ashamed of it. And I am so glad that there's a place like this where you're you know, having discussions, dialogues. This is wonderful. I've never known that there was a place like this. You know, I'm telling you, I'm just amazed. And the reason why my son is not here today is because I didn't find you 4 years ago. I would have tried to convince him to study here. But anyway, I think long and short of it is sometimes maybe we don't have to worry so much about what you think or what I think. You know, maybe we just, you know, go with what I think God leads us to do. Is that okay? I mean, I just want to ask you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, like what Jack said about we all have different stories, we all are diverse. I mean,
yes.
We all, in some ways, our faithful experience is handcrafted for the kinds of roles we play as being sanctified and as spreading the good news. Yes. Like, there's something about, I mean, I work in social service. I like working with people who are in really hard straits.
Yes.
I don't want to work with your population. Like,
yes.
I don't want to sound like I could spell or sound like I spell. That's kind of funny. Yeah, there's a number of things that I wouldn't want to do in your job. But
but
you seem remarkably suited to it. And I like that part of what you're describing is the blowback to your faith and your desire to emphasize the Bible is actually coming from the establishment that's supposedly religious. Now, we all have parked in that parking spot before. We know what that's
like.
So, again, as we go forward, regardless of generational places, if we remove the political elements of what we're trying to do, what is God calling you to do?
Yes.
It could be a food shelter. It could be leading a prayer group. It could be knitting.
Yes.
I'm all a respecter of all kinds of persons. So, however you feel like, man, I want my faith to be manifest here. I mean, I think Peter's sincere. He wants to know how to talk and be amongst the generations that are coming. He wants to care about them.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that's been denied him right now,
or
why he feels distance from that. That's something that he should be taking to God, because God will bring that when that happens. I brought up my brother a little with someone I think, and he's 10 years younger than me. He was 7 when my father left. I was 17. It hasn't been given to me to talk to him. Like, I love him, but I took my dad's role and my brother Boomer rebelled against me instead. And so it hasn't been given to me. I love him. He goes about his life. We live in the same town. I see him once every 7 to 8 months. I care about him deeply, but he cannot disassociate me from his role, for the role of the father, and also from my religious position. Like, so I kind of flip a coin on that one. Like, I love him. If he came to my doorstep homeless, I would let him in every time. But it hasn't been given to me to speak truth. And I think there's a lot of pressure that we put on ourselves to feel like, oh man, I have this one relative or this one kid, and I just I want them to believe so badly. But you don't know their story. That's not for you to decide. Like, do your best to not get in the way of yourself. Like, but yeah, that's what I got.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I just actually, I mean, I have two things. I want to offer an assessment of your talk and then see if I have it right. I have like 2 points to make.
Okay,
but
go.
First, your pacing is good. I think everyone else just needs to keep up. So don't let people tell you to slow down. So,
I appreciate that.
So it seems to me first that you are not so much responding. Well, let me change it. What you're responding to in Jack's paper is generally a set of presuppositions, perhaps the tone and the tenor. And that sort of thing. But when it actually comes to positive points that Jack makes, you have a tendency to grant them. One, I mean, for example, like, there's this liberal superior class. Yes, there is, but there's also this conservative one. Things like persecution is probably going to ramp up in the future. Say, sure, but is that really something we should be concerned about? And then finally, I think when Jack presents the idea that what we really ought to do, our response to this whole thing, is that we ought to focus on how to live our individual lives and how to structure our relationships with other individuals, we just need to focus on how to do that in a biblical and godly way. So it seems to me like you agree with those points, which are essentially the positive points, but you're disagreeing with a whole set of precepts. Is that right? Am I?
In so much that I might be in trouble, sure. Sounds good.
Okay. That's okay. Then I was trying. I mean, when Juan was talking, I was thinking the same thing. And so there's trying to identify these presuppositions, because like you, I don't quite understand where the generation above us is coming from. It seems like one of them is probably, I mean, that I think you explicitly reject, is the notion that the nominally Christian culture that we are essentially coming out of, you reject the notion that it has any value or actually is a Christian culture. It's sure. As I think the way I think of it, or I've heard someone put it, it's a very thin veneer of ostensibly biblical language over just a lot of ugliness and sin and evil.
No.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay, sure.
Keep something going. Like that.
Yeah, we'll all agree.
Yeah. So I'm wondering also, though, there's another one that I think has come up when Ron spoke and some other people, is, and I've noticed this with myself, is it the case that you are uncomfortable with talking about groups, by which I mean to say, like, when we say a generation or a culture or a political party, those are essentially useful fictions. What they really are is aggregations of individuals. And it seems to me often when people ask, how should I treat this group or this generation, your response is, I don't know, they're a set of individuals.
Yeah.
Have a relationship with individuals and structure those in a godly manner, and that will solve the problem. Is that, am I capturing that right? I mean,
well, could you say that second part? You talk faster than I was ready for.
You just need to keep up. You just need to keep up.
Now I know what you all feel like.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if part of what you see as a disconnect in the dialogue is the propensity for certain, I mean, and I don't think it's a generational thing, it's just some people find it very, very useful to talk about groups. And I think you, every time questions have been phrased in that way, you have changed it and said, we need to think about the individuals who make
sure.
up those groups. I'm wondering, I mean, I don't know if you have anything to say about that, or if I just kind of
I do. I think, well, I talked about generations a lot. We could also do political groups. They're fine. When you think about generations, it's a guideline. Like, Ron is a boomer in the same way that Jack, but they are not the same boomer. In fact, I think Ron shares more with my generation with respect to humility, because Jack's an egomaniac. No, that's not implied. Like, no, but Ron is not going out guns blazing. Ron is approaching this mic with a sort of like, this is where I think I'm coming at things. In a way that's like, almost, and you have to be talked about, Ron, I'm sorry, almost as if like a stiff breeze might knock him off the mic. Or and it's funny, Ron, I think, is always more conscientious that he could say something that could be misconstrued. And Jack is more, I think, concerned with saying something that could be dismissed. Jack is going to make his point, and you will understand his point when he's made it. Ron is going to make his point, and you'll understand that you can talk to Ron for 14 hours over coffee, and he will, like, be the best person. So it's a different thing. Like, to answer your question without an example, yes, we can speak of groups, but there should just simply be, like, guideline thing. The individuals, that's where the heart resonates. You'll see it. And it's either there, it's not, kind of thing. Do you have a part of that question?
Yeah.
I just have a question. I'm not really sure what you mean by a culture war. Could you clarify that for me and how that's...
I can't.
Yeah, because that would be great, because that would make the whole paper.
I have
more sense.
By culture war, I mean a contest of who defines the... values.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean socially, in the sense of social, there's a word that I'm not finding. That's what I mean. So, as we use the word family, who's going to define what family means?
Mm-hmm.
So, when we say the word family values, you want to lean a little right, because that's the catchphrase that the superior class on the right has invented. So, there was a period from the 80s to the Obama second thing, where the contest was about language, really, fundamentally. Is what are we going to call these things? When we say America, what do we mean? When we say equality, does it include gays or not? Like, when we say family values, do we mean broken household? Do we mean same-sex household? Do we mean only households that are Christian? Like, it was a contest of language. And what's funny is the more I read linguists, like, I mean, Wittgenstein's interesting, and Chomsky's marvelous. Oh, man, you're going to hate this thing out, Logan. But yeah, language is huge, and the culture war really needs to be grasped in the sense of, like, we're going to make value judgments based on certain language, and that was the tension. The tension was the progressives wanted to define values this way, and the Republicans wanted to define values this way, and it was those two forces forcing the conflict through legislation that is really what I'm seeing as the culture war in the sense of what I was describing. That seems to be the tension, is when I hear the hot button issue. I heard a liberal friend of mine put up this conspiracy that he said, you know what they did? Because this is a conspiracy, and everybody has conspiracies on both sides, so they're both wackos. He goes, they got a supercomputer right before Reagan was elected, and they put into the supercomputer all the single vote issues. Like, so in other words, like, all the single vote issues, like, you either agree with abortion or you don't agree with abortion. Like the hot button issues, and they put all this stuff in the computer, and it spit out Reagan's platform. Like, that's his theory. It's this idea that, now, there's an elegance of all theories have this kind of bristling of truth. This idea that Reagan's platform was constructed so as to force people to make yes or no decisions about their entire political identity. Well, that's what happened in some ways. Like, the culture war was about those definition of values. Whether a computer was involved and Reagan was secretly conspiring to do it, I don't know. But values. Values and the definition of language is basically the culture war. Which is why the evangelicals lost, because they lost the fight on marriage. They weren't even fighting the right war with sex. They have no idea what they're 100 years behind the war on sex. They have no idea what they're talking about. Like, because evangelicals have lost the language war, and we're now going to define America in the sense of the liberty that will now be written. Another question? Are you good? Ask me your question another way. And
then how is it something that's just political and not like and separate from, like, morality and faith? Because it seems like it comes down to, like, how are we defining what is moral and good? And how can you separate that politicalness from the faith end of...
Good question, because it's probably one of the hard answers. Because I think the hardest thing... So, and this is what part of... If I wasn't a divine determinist, none of this would make sense to me. And what I mean by that is, if I hadn't come to terms with the concept that we are saved by faith and not by works, and I get into this and it's huge and it's dynamic, but I empathize with what you're saying, because what I think what you said was, my morality is something that is valuable to me. And because I live in a democratic society, I want to vote from my conscience and from my morality. And therefore, that seemed to have led me on this path. And I totally empathize with that. That's why I voted for Bush both times. And in fact, I voted for Bush the second time mostly because I couldn't stand how the liberals were talking the whole time. They were so vile and insidious. They hated Bush for such irrational reasons. I didn't know he would do that whole thing with Iraq. I really didn't like that at all. But the venom of both sides was so repellent to me, which is why, anyway. So you vote your conscience. You vote your morality. that seems like it makes a lot of sense, and in many ways I would never, ever prescribe you voting away. I'm not going to say you should vote away. I'm saying I just want to clarify that our intellectual commitment to the Bible is the thing that we should be pursuing and pursuing and be persecuted for if we're going to be persecuted. Can you still vote Republican? Yeah, I'm not saying you vote Republican. Vote Republican. But it gets tricky because my objection to the culture war is because it was about values and what I'm calling political orthodoxy, because you had to be a certain way to be among the evangelicals, because you had to be conservative because the pressure was there, it distracted us from actually the thing that we're trying to do, which is make the leap, is to actually pursue faith. So evangelical, as they shore up their political power, and evangelicals in general as they go to church, they like the comfort of agreement and consensus. It eases the salve and ache of humanity and our limited knowledge about things. It eases the sting of faith and how hard faith is. Making judgments about other people and their sanctification based on moral parameters is stupid. It's stupid. Like, so my objection to voting immorality is, vote your immorality, but you're not, you might inherently be un-American by doing so. Because you have to redefine equality. If you're going to define marriage in the context of man and woman and not man and man, you've done something to the word equality. You've preserved your word family, but you've done something to the very nature of what I think also America is good for. That's the best I can do.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful.